Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thank you all for joining us. We appreciate your patience, and we have a guest who's in town this week. We thought we'd do something different. I want to announce we're going to have the videotape of the presentation that Dr. Juma made on Friday, so we'll have that up on stream. And the other thing I'd like to announce is he has never missed a presentation before in his career. So he will be coming back in the winter quarter. You will get to see him in person. So I wanted to mention that. We had about 200 students that met with him while he was here, and they're pretty pleased at those discussions. So we will have him back. Tonight we've got Jim Nelson with us. We're delighted to have him. He's had an extensive career in offshore oil and gas and really innovation in that domain. He will be talking about some of the implications for us on the central coast of California. And we are delighted to have you with us, Jim. So without further ado, Jim Nelson. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess this is on. As you can see, the title is Oil Seeps and Sustainable Infrastructure, Two Subsea Revolutionaries Tackle Oil Seeps. I'm not sure if I could qualify for either of those, but Ladd Handelman, my partner in crime, will be showing up here, and I'm going to talk about Laddie first. Ladd came out here to Santa Barbara in the early 1960s. He came from either Brooklyn or the Bronx, and I never can get it right, and he always gets mad at me when I miss it. He was an abalone fisherman originally, and he was one of the Blackfeet group. And that was really his whole credo of his career. He said it didn't matter how good you looked, didn't matter who you knew, didn't matter what kind of equipment you had, what party you belonged to. All that mattered was the number of abalone that you put on the deck each day. In 1965, when Texaco began drilling in the Santa Barbara Channel and it went beyond 250 feet, then you couldn't do air diving anymore. And this is a picture of Laddie as he's doing diving in the channel back then. What you needed was a mixture of both helium and oxygen. They had tables from the Navy, but they were out of date. So basically, Laddie and the divers, about one out of every two dives, they got bent. But it was, they really pioneered the entire subsea area when it comes to going deeper than you can with air diving. He formed his company, called it California Divers, and this is a picture from the late 1960s. With CalDive, Laddie. In fact, I believe you had Matt Simmons as one of your speakers for this group. Matt actually was the Ladd met Matt back in 1969, and we were the first transaction Ladd ever did. In 1971, he merged with a large company, and it was called, they changed the name to Oceaneering. Oceaneering is a well-recognized name in the industry, as is CalDive. In 1969, Basically, his headquarters was here in California, in Santa Barbara, and the headquarters of the company was out on, what is the name of the wharf? Stearns Wharf. But all the business was in the Gulf of Mexico, so they wanted Laddie to move. He wouldn't do it, so they fired him. He started CalDive again in 1979, and then in 1983 was sold to a big company called Diversified Energies. But the way, you know, life changes, in 1985, January, Laddie, you know, was on top of the world. He'd sold his company, had a bunch of money, but he was still running the company, had a big earnout. But he, you know, he was really a pioneer, and nothing would ever scare him. So he went skiing at Mammoth in January of 1985. I think he was a marginal skier at best. And he was challenged to go down a new double diamond run, which he did. Lost control, and went off a cliff, fell 800 feet, and broke his neck. And then I don't know where, okay, there we go. And then he rolled another 1,200 feet. So Laddie's a quadriplegic today. Been in that wheelchair for 22 years. but he is one of the most incredible guys you'll ever want to meet. He's got all sorts of energy. So I actually met Laddie then in late 1985. I was with the large company and was given the responsibility to see if we could save Caldive. I didn't know anything about the subsea business, so I called Laddie. He was on a retainer, and I said, I'm assuming you're getting a little tired of feeling sorry for yourself. Do you want to help me figure out how to save your company? So he and I worked together for several years, and then the big company, this, you know, oil in 1986, oil was down at $8 a barrel. So the company I was with made a downsizing operation, and I was looking for something to do. Did a traditional job search for 6 months, couldn't find any work. And then Laddie came to me, and he said, you know, I've found this thing that I've set up that I think is really going to be a winner. It's the project is called the Capitan of San Jose, trying to find the richest treasure ship ever known on this earth. And I said, Laddie, I'm a big corporate guy. I don't do treasure ships. And he was quiet for a little bit, and then he said, so what else are you doing right now? So I took on that task. Oops. This is the Capitan of San Jose, a Spanish galleon sunk in 1708 off the coast of Cartagena. It's in about 1,500 feet of water, maybe 2,000 feet. An American group had spent $10 million to find the location, and we're pretty sure that they had it. But then the Colombians ran them off, and so that's where Laddie came in. He'd done a lot of work with Sweden. And actually in Colombia, a lot of the infrastructure is Swedish. Ericsson is their telephone system and so on. So Laddie put together a consortium between the governments of Colombia and Sweden. And then what we needed was $2.5 million of new capital to confirm that that was, in fact, the site. So I'll be darned if I didn't go out with Laddie and I actually raised the $2.5 million. Surprised the hell out of me. I'm a finance guy. I never sold anything. So we did that. Unfortunately, the president of Colombia changed. The new president did not have the same passion for the treasure venture, and also by that time the drug lords were pretty much running the company. So the investors got their money back, and then 2 years later, the company, Caldive, the parent company, was being sold, and so the company was available. I was still looking for something to do, and Caldive in 1989 had done $19 million in revenue, lost $2 million at the operating line. The management had negotiated a purchase price of $11 million, and they came to me and asked me if I would join the team and see if I could raise the money. Here comes Mr. Hendelman now. I wasn't too sure about this, and so I talked to Laddie about it, and Laddie said, well, you know, you've been with all these big companies all these years, and if you join Caldive and if you guys make it work, he said, then no dumb shit will ever fire your ass again. So in 1990, this is what Caldive looked like. There were three principals, myself and my two partners, Jerry Rule and Owen Kratz. In that period, I'd read a book. Some of you, I'm sure probably a lot of you have heard it, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. Andrew Carnegie had commissioned him to write this book back in the early 1900s, and he talked to all of the successful people trying to come up with, what makes a good company work. There's a term in there called a mastermind group, and I didn't know what it meant, but it sure worked at Caldive. Jerry, Owen, and I were just a perfect match. Individually, we could not have done anything near what we did do. Jerry was good with the divers, a real honest, straightforward guy. Owen was just an incredibly creative guy. And I did the financial and the administrative side of it. So the three of us, the total purchase price was $11 million. We were trying to borrow $10 million. So the three of us had to each come up, first of all, with $100,000. I didn't have any money by this time, but they said, well, if you can raise the money, that'll be your contribution. Jerry had some money. Owen did not have much of anything. So he did have an old boat over in Hawaii. He sold that for $40,000. And then to get the other $60,000, he maxed out 22 credit cards. And his secretary still talks about it. She was down in the bank, and they had all these cards laid out, and they were completing them. Owen today is probably worth a little over $200 million. So then we offered it to key employees. We had 18 key employees that became shareholders. And then Merrill Lynch was nice enough to bring all the money. So we had nothing but three vessels and some general diving. One of the things Laddie did when CalDive had some money in the early 80s, 1980s, is we got into saturation diving. You can see the bell on this side. And that basically, a guy will go down in that. He's pressurized at the depth that he's going to be working. They can work down to 1,000 feet. He'll come out and they can work a 12-hour shift. And then he'll come back into this bell. It'll go up into the vessel and it'll lock in the vessel. So he'll stay in that saturated environment for as long as we had work. We had one team that was down for 53 days. So it's a dangerous, incredibly dangerous business. You're working alone. Often you can't see what you're doing. But you make pretty good money. So we bought the company in 1990. This slide I like. I used it for an annual report. In 1992, oil had fallen back down. We were at $12 a barrel. Everyone was leaving the Gulf of Mexico. It was called the Dead Sea in the industry. The outer continental shelf was pretty well picked over. And so everyone was really going to foreign locations. Only Shell had an idea and had drilled some wells out beyond the outer continental shelf, beyond 1,000 feet, and had an idea that there was something out in the deep water Gulf. This picture that you see to my right, which would be your right, that's the Yucatan Peninsula. Straight ahead is Florida, and then New Orleans and the Texas are to the right. This is what the Gulf looks like. It comes from 1,000 feet at the outer continental shelf at its deepest, and then it drops off. The depth here is 14,000 feet at its deepest part. And you can see what happened was this massive meteorite came clunk. And that's what caused the formation. And that's what gave rise to the deepwater Gulf of Mexico. It's one of the most prolific basins. Some of you, I mean, we are now drilling as an industry. We are drilling and completing in 31,000 feet. In other words, 15,000 feet of water, and then you go beyond that. My point basically is that in 1992, no one understood, no one really knew that there was a deepwater Gulf of Mexico or what it would hold. And I'll come back to the importance of that when I get here to California. We could see, as the drilling moved into the deep water, that we needed to move beyond the shallow water vessels we had. So we began to build a fleet of dynamically positioned vessels. That's what you see working here. There's a semi-submersible in the middle, the top right, and then one of our vessels. They're dynamically positioned, which means that it's too deep to set anchors. So what you do is you read off of satellites, and they position you, and you have motors that keep you set in place. And you can see they're working down on the ocean bottom. I don't know if you can see. Yeah, you can see the manifold that's down there, and it ties back, and then it goes into the production facility, which is a spar. Well, we built a brand new one of these semi-submersibles, brought that in early 2000. The thing that was interesting about it is we'd try anything. 1997, I should also mention, is the year that we went public. And in the interim, we'd given stock options to a number of our employees. And so now, at least, we were a public company, and we had a public market. We also wound up buying that spar that you see in the back. We own 50% of that, and we actually built two tension leg platforms that we had an interest in. And again, people were, what are they doing? It's just we were not constrained by a specific strategy, and that really is Owen. The other thing we did in 1999, let me back up, in 1992, we were doing salvage work. In other words, we were removing the old platforms like you've got out here, plugging and abandoning the well and so on. But we were seeing that there was an awful lot of reserves that were left. The majors, you know, when it get down to a certain level, it was just too small for them to mess around with. So the industry was going through a downsizing again in 1992. We hired three guys that had been with ARCO for umpteen years and started our own little oil and gas company called Energy Resource Technology. And basically, we'd buy these older fields. And it turned out to be an incredibly successful business. So by 1999, we had an established track record. And what we were trying to do, we had all these deep water vessels. What we wanted to do was to, since we had reservoir experience, the construction vessels, we wanted to see if we could find an oil company that would allow us to come in as a working interest partner so that we wouldn't have to go through all the bidding stuff. And we finally found one, Kerr McGee, and they agreed that we could have a 20% interest in the field Gunnison, which you see out here in Garden Banks. It was in the Western Gulf in a completely undiscovered, undrilled area. The water depth, 4,500 feet. Our reservoir engineers looked at it. It was a rank wildcat, and as you may know, that when you're drilling a wildcat, the chances of success are about 1 in 10. This one looked to us better, 1 in 8. But part of our procedures and practices as a public company is we told our shareholders that we would only do fields where there was established production. We would not do any exploration. So we had to come up with our share of the dry hole cost, which was $20 million. We thought we had an industry partner that was going to put up that part of the money, and then if it was successful, then Caldive would come in with our money and our shareholders to do the development and the construction work. Well, the industry partners didn't like it when the rig was mobilizing, and so we lost them. And we'd worked a year to put this thing together. And so Owen, at this point, Jerry and I had sold some of our stock. But Owen had pretty much held all his stock. So on paper, Owen was wealthy. Anyway, Owen said, well, I'll put up the $20 million because we'd worked so hard, he didn't want to see us lose it. And I said, well, Owen, you've been my partner all these years. I don't want to see you do this by yourself. I'll put up $200,000. And a couple of the other guys, I think we had about 7 or 8. We threw in $1 million, and Owen put up $19 million. Well, it turned out to be a successful field. I think when all is said and done, Gunnison will have anywhere from 75 to 80 million barrels of oil in it. One of the other things we did, you know, in the industry, having experienced people, particularly in the last several years, it's just there's such a dearth of people available. You've got, in our industry, you've got a 40% of the people are 60 years and older. And then there's just a gap when nobody went into the oil and gas industries. We've got some people coming out of college. But we needed to find a way to keep our people. So Owen came up with this idea that, you know, after the original investors, being basically him and the other 6 or 7 of us, got their original money back twice, then we'd take 40% of the net revenue coming out of this field, and that would go to, we identified, I think, 78 key employees. They didn't have to do anything other than you had to stay in order, you know, to be around when you got the monthly revenue checks. And I'll tell you, that was one great golden handcuff. And it meant so much to our people. I know there's a woman in our payroll department that is a single mother. She's got 4 young kids. The revenue check she gets from Gunnison each month is a little more than her salary. So it was, I mean, it's never been done before, and I'm sure it'll never be done again, but we did it. Let me go back here. Oops, I'm now really lost. Oh, laddie, you didn't see this picture. That's you. Okay. When I retired in 2004, that company that we paid $11 million for and borrowed $10 million of it was worth about $3 billion. It's now publicly traded. Well, they kept wanting to change the name, CalDive. And then, you know, we had all these bright analysts come in and tell us, well, look, you haven't worked in offshore California in three decades. Diving is only 20% of your business. And I just didn't, I mean, it was a great brand name. I didn't want to leave it. So when I retired, not long thereafter, they changed the name of the parent company. It's now called Helix Energy Solutions. It's on the New York Exchange under HLX. When I heard the name, I said, God, I seem to remember my mother having a cleaner called Hilux or something like that. I didn't particularly like the name. We did save the name CalDive. We spun out the diving portion of the business, and that's also publicly traded, and I think it's on the New York Exchange. Ticker is DVR. So by the time I retired, by my last count, we had made 47 millionaires of our people, and that included office people, offshore hands, and I'm sure in the last 4 years that we're well over 50 and probably close to 60. So it was an incredible success. Then I came out here to visit Laddie a little over a year and a half ago, and he started talking to me about this thing he wanted me to help him with, which was dealing with the pollution that's in the Santa Barbara Channel. Right here in where the environmental movement began in 1969. I said, Laddie, I think the treasure ship is going to be easy compared to this. So we formed a nonprofit company called SOS California. You can see our mission statement, dedicated to reducing the environmental impact of natural oil and gas seep pollution on our ocean beaches and atmosphere through education and awareness. That's evolved into basically four stools that we're dealing with. First, we're doing fact-based research and doing PowerPoint presentations like this. And what we're trying to get across is, first of all, the extent of pollution caused by natural oil and gas seeps. That extraction, producing the underlying oil and gas reserves, will reduce the pressure and reduce the seepage problem. That exploration and production of the reserves can be conducted in an environmentally safe manner. And that once you produce it, you can then sell it, and the royalty revenues can fund the transition to alternative sources of energy. So I'll talk a little bit about each of these aspects of what we're doing in SOS California. What Laddie got my attention with was just the extent of pollution. I had no idea that what was happening here in the Santa Barbara Channel. And certainly, I think as we've gone around and made these presentations, we found that most people are unaware of the magnitude of the pollution. Natural gas and oil seepage is the greatest source of oil pollution in the ocean and in the atmosphere. This is a study done by the National Academy of Science. You can see that the source of oil pollution in American waters, cars, boats, and so on, 32%, petroleum tankering, 4%, drilling and extraction, less than 1%, and then natural seeps, 63%. Oops. Good. These are a list that shows in, it's a little hard to see, the seeps that are here in the offshore in the Santa Barbara Channel. There are 2,000 active natural seeps, and what those are, they're basically cracks in the ocean floor, and the oil gets pushed through them, through the pressure that's underneath it. It's the second largest seep area in the entire world. The largest is in the Caspian Sea. One thing we've heard is that, well, gosh, they're natural. You know, how can anything be bad that's natural? So the first thing, I'm going to ask a question. Where, when, and how did the oil and gas industry begin in the United States? Would you like to take a shot? Good. Got 58.
Yeah.
And and how did they discover it?
It just leaks up out of the ground.
It was a seep. It was a natural seep leaking up out of the ground. So that started the whole industry. So, that's the source of our product. And I don't have much. Anyway, they are natural. But what are they doing here? I mentioned they're the second largest marine oil seeps in the world. Every day, the amount of oil that's coming through those fissures is about 10,000 gallons. It's been measured fairly accurately, or in other words, 250 gallons of oil per day is coming out of these natural cracks, these seeps. What that means is that every 12 months, we have the same quantity of oil in the ocean here in the Santa Barbara Channel that's equivalent to the Santa Barbara oil spill. And these are some shots from back in 1969 when we had that spill. So it's the same amount of oil that's coming into the water. Some of the people that are anti-development are saying, well, you know, it comes over a period of time. It's not an immediate thing like the oil spill. Well, I think Flatty said, try telling that to a bird. Every 4 years, about 270,000 barrels of oil are leaked into the channel. That's the equivalent of the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. I think everyone knows that we've got an awful lot of tar on the beaches here. 55% of the tar on the beaches in Los Angeles County come from Coal Oil Point. And you can even get it down in Monterey beaches. If we've accomplished nothing else, our local politician, what is her name, Lois Capps? She used to always talk about the pristine beaches in Santa Barbara. She no longer uses pristine. I mean, and it's simply a fact of life that people that have lived here realize that you've got tar, you have to figure out how to get it off your feet. Obviously, and we've got documentation that we've done in terms of the impact, the continuing impact. Yes, the birds and the mammals have learned how to sort of move around the seeps, but we've got documentation in terms of the number of birds that are injured each year and that have to be rescued, and the number of birds that die, and so on. The other thing that there hasn't been a whole lot of study of, you've got the oil seeping up, but those of you that have taken a tour of the seep area, and that initial slide that you saw, that's natural gas that's bubbling up. So you've got both oil coming up and natural gas. The emissions, the natural gas, it's one of the largest contributors to air pollution here in Santa Barbara County. When the natural gas bubbles up, it hits the sunlight and the air, and then it forms really a precursor to smog, a reactive organic compound. It's a significant pollutant, and those seeps annually contribute over 6,000 tons of reactive organic compounds to the air pollution here. All the transportation vehicles in the county contribute only 4,000 tons. So that's something you don't see in terms of the pollution of the air quality that's coming from the seeps. So my summary of this is that the seeps are really significant. We've gotten a lot of people saying, well, it's a non-issue. Well, I mean, I've gone through the facts, and they're well documented. So from our standpoint, it's an issue, and in fact, the current term we've used, it's an environmental disaster that's happening in slow motion. So the next thing we move to is the extraction of underlying oil and gas reserves is a solution to the problem. You know, I've worked with geologists all my life, and when I asked them, well, sure, I mean, you've got the reserves that sit underneath the seeps, that pressure pushes the oil up, so just logically it makes sense. There is also significant evidence that extraction can reduce the reservoir pressure and thus the seepage pollution. This is an aerial shot of Coal Oil Point, and you can see on any day, in fact, when I flew in here, this is exactly what I was looking at. They've done UCSB actually did an extensive study of what happened around Platform Holly. You can see in the top, they started with sonar, and you can see the impact of the seepage in 1973. By 1995, you can see how much of this cleared up, and if you extrapolate that, it's down about 80% from the production of the underlying reserves. This is a press release that was issued regarding that study, and you can read some of the important pieces here. So it is well documented that, and again, as I said, it makes logical sense to me. The Santa Barbara North County area seeps are pictured here. My point is that there are basically 13 major reservoir deposits in the channel. 11 of the seeps overlay them. So one of the arguments we hear is that, well, it may be true at Cold Oil Point, but it's not true elsewhere. And again, I think the what we have been proposing is, well, let's try something different. Let's produce and see if we actually see the same type of reduction. The second or the third leg of our stool is that oil and gas exploration and production can be conducted in an environmentally safe manner. And again, that's the thing we run into here all the time. Well, there's a tremendous risk that we'll have another major thing like the Santa Barbara oil spill of 1969. When you think back to 1969, I was early in my career then, we had nothing but these massive mainframe computers, and you had cards that you fit into the things. Just think about the technology that's changed in the last 40 years. You've all got your BlackBerries and cell phones, and you can run your entire life. So the industry has also made significant increases during that period. Today we have got incredibly redundant offshore fail-safe mechanisms. You can see pictures of them here. Every bit of what the industry does today is based upon safety. These offshore fail-safe mechanisms shut down automatically whenever there's an issue. So let's see what happened before we had these types of systems in place. This is a picture of Hurricane Betsy, which hit the Gulf of Mexico in 1965. We didn't have fail-safe mechanisms, and this is a picture that Laddie gave to me. Laddie and the California divers, their crew was called over to actually try to cap these wells. And you can see the damage. A lot of the platforms were wooden. And I think you said, Laddie, the noise was incredible. I mean, what Laddie and the divers did, they had to go in underwater and get above the well bore and try to put something on it to stop it. He's still here. Let's then fast forward 40 years. Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, two 150-year storms, both hit in the same year, within a month, came right down the fairway of all of the oil and gas production in the Gulf of Mexico. The devastation, we're still cleaning up pieces of it 2 to 3 years later. 100 platforms were completely destroyed and taken out of service. 3,000 platforms, there's a little over 4,000 in the Gulf, so 75% of them were damaged. 1,000 subsea wells were destroyed. 22,000 miles of pipelines were damaged. And yet, there were no significant spills, no shoreline or wildlife impact. In other words, those fail-safe mechanisms work. So from my standpoint, I can assure the risk of a major blowout, yeah, there's always a small risk, but it's quite nominal. In fact, if you look at the pollution, oil pollution, that has been here in the Santa Barbara Channel since 1970, you can see that the natural seeps we've estimated have put about 1.8 million barrels of oil into the ocean water. Offshore operations during the same period, 842 barrels. That's the little green thing. So again, I get a little frustrated with this. Well, we've got a massive risk of another major blowout. We've worked real hard as an industry to prevent that. So finally, if we can produce the reserves, if they can help reduce the seepage, you've then got the revenues, royalty revenues, and those revenues can fund the transition to alternative sources of energy. What are we looking at? First of all, even now we're down at still $3 to $4 a gallon, and why? I think you've all heard the reasons for that. Rapid demand growth in China and India. Of course, there have been no refineries built here in this country since the 1970s. 85% of the offshore oil and gas reserves have been off limits through the various moratorium. One of the arguments you hear, well, there's very little reserves, a 30-day supply or something like that. Based upon old seismic, which is all we have right now in these areas, it's estimated that there are 110 billion barrels of oil and 425 TCF of natural gas that's out there. I am quite sure that if you turn the industry loose, we would just blow away those numbers. And again, think back to my example of the Deepwater Gulf of Mexico. The drilling that we could do here if you get on offshore California, I'm sure would certainly outpace the numbers that I'm going to talk about in a minute. And of course, the pressure, when you've got people paying $4 a gallon here and traveling what they do, as you, many of you are probably aware, the offshore moratorium, which has been in place in this country since 1981, that was lifted. There simply wasn't the political will to keep that in place. If you look at the reserves that are estimated offshore California, there's some, what we have here is a picture of where the fields are. It's estimated in the channel there's anywhere from 1 to 4 billion barrels. On the outer continental shelf, 10 to 14 billion barrels. And again, those are, I think, they're old numbers, and I'm sure we'll come in higher than that. The other thing that's happened in the last, gosh, just 10 years, is we, as an industry, the technology of slant drilling is really improved to a point where we can drill with slant drilling 7 miles. So all of the Santa Barbara Channel could be drilled from onshore. And then we could use the existing platforms to drill out into the outer continental shelf. You wouldn't see any additional infrastructure. Everything is in place, particularly here. So another one of the arguments you hear, well, there wouldn't be any impact of revenue for years. Well, with the infrastructure that we have here, you'd have oil and gas online within 12 to 18 months. What are some of the benefits of that? Well, the first thing, we've got tankers that are running around, and everyone remembers the tanker that hit the bridge up in San Francisco within the last year and what it spilled. Well, we wouldn't need those tankers running around here. We could reduce our, right now California imports, actually it's about 40% of its oil from such wonderful places as Oman, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela. We could substantially reduce that foreign oil imports. As you know, there have been talk about building LNG terminals. We wouldn't need liquefied natural gas. So some of the benefits, obviously, we would deal with the oil and gas pollution in coastal waters, the tar on the beaches. We'd improve the air quality, the shoreline habitat. And then, again, in this area where you've got a state that has got the deficit that both the state and the county do, the idea of a significant new source of revenue, as well as the high-paying jobs that would come with this, to us is very significant. We've made a number of estimates of what that would actually mean, and you can see the numbers here. And what the, you know, when we started this, a lot of these presentations, oil was up near $150 a barrel. Today, it's 68. I think you'll see it settle about 100. That's where demand and supply should have it. What that would mean, anywhere in that range, at a low, I've got, I think we're using $70 a barrel here. That would generate $170 million to Santa Barbara County, over $1 billion a year to the state of California. A royalty is available when you produce offshore. It has been 16 2/3% in the Gulf of Mexico. The states of Louisiana and Alabama have increased their share to 18%. So we're estimating that you could take 15% for the state and 3% for the county. And again, the oil companies would be more than happy to renegotiate these royalty splits, as you certainly saw with the deal that Plains Exploration recently signed. So we could then, with that source of money, you can see some of the numbers that it would mean over a number of years, and we could fund all sorts of things. And certainly the conversion to solar, and again, what we're trying to do is use this revenue to provide the transition to alternative sources of energy. On the ballot this year, I think there's a $10 billion bond. Californians are already paying $4 at the gas pump. That's a massive new tax on top of that in order to get to renewable energy. To us, it makes new sense to produce the oil and gas and use those funds to convert the transition to alternative sources of energy. So that is what we're about. As I mentioned, Laddie is here. Is Bruce here? I thought Bruce Allen might be coming. No Bruce. Judy Rossiter is over here, our executive director. And with that, Bill, I'm ready for questions.
Thank you.
So is Laddie. Let him talk for a while.
Holy applause. You haven't all met Lad yet, so hang on.
Here we go. So now that the ban has been lifted off drilling on the Outer Continental Shelf, what's stopping this or preventing this from happening? Is it Coastal Commission?
Yeah, now it would have to go through the Coastal Commission. That would be the next step, yes.
And so then I'm just curious, what I don't know that much about drilling in the oil industry in general. I'm curious about the startup costs for this, or how much would it cost to do this? I'm just curious.
Well, the oil companies would bear it. I mean, they're the ones that would pay for it.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, just how much would it cost them? I'm just curious.
Oh, gosh. It varies. It varies in terms of the depth of the water. If you get out off the Outer Continental Shelf, like the Gunnison project that I was talking about, the dry hole cost was $100 million, and when you put in the development cost, it was about $400
million
to drill and complete and produce. And again, that cost would be a lot less here because you've got the infrastructure. You've got the pipelines. You've got the platforms. We can drill from onshore.
Hi. You make it seem really obvious that offshore drilling is like completely like cool and normal. So what's the argument against it? Because it's not very popular with anybody.
Well, if you ever talk about an industry that could really have used some PR help. You know, when we had that 69 oil spill, you had the president of, who was it? Who did the oil?
Fred Hartley, Union Oil Company.
Union Oil Company, and he basically said, well, what the hell's wrong with a couple of dead birds, for God's sake? And that sort of started it. And, the people in our industry, and you get people like Laddie and these wildcatters, I mean, they just like to find oil. So our industry has had just a terrible image. And you look at the other thing we hear, well, you know, these obscene profits that the oil and gas industry has been making. Well, if you look at the return on invested capital, and that goes back to your question, it's a very large base of invested capital. Over the last four decades, the industry has averaged about between 7% and 8% return on invested capital. Go up to Silicon Valley, they run 18% to 19%. There have been some really tough years. In fact, in my period with CalDive of almost 20 years, we had maybe three really good years and 10 so-so years and five or six really bad years. So it's a cyclical industry. I'm wandering away from your question. Did I answer it? Okay.
Yeah, you mentioned that if we start drilling, then, maybe... You mentioned that the price of gas is $4, but would it really affect if we did start drilling all the offshore? Would it drop it?
Absolutely.
With the world price, even with the U.S. having only 3%?
Yep, great question. And that's an argument we hear all the time. But part of that price that you see out there is that the world knows we've got X amount of reserves here in this country, and we're not going after them. If we announced that we were turning our industry loose on our reserves, there'd be an immediate impact. And you saw that a little bit when Bush lifted the presidential moratorium. And it just makes sense. If we are going to actually increase the supply, it's going to have an impact upon the price.
I was wondering if you have given this presentation to Governor Schwarzenegger and to Lois Capps, and what the current political situation is on this, because I know that that's probably gummed up this for quite a while.
Laddie surprised me. We worked hard on the Santa Barbara County Commission, and we made a presentation. All the environmental groups were there opposing it, and they actually voted for it. They voted 3-2 to send a letter to Schwarzenegger encouraging him to go ahead with offshore drilling. I think, well, certainly you saw that the Democrats didn't think they had the power to keep the moratorium in place, so they let it expire. The thing that bothers me most, and again, it makes no sense to me. Why are people paying $4 when you've got all this oil sitting right here? What you'll see the environmentalists come with lawsuits and try to stop the entire thing if they... So there, it, one of the bills that I saw was trying to say that you had to take all of the lawsuits and put them into one bag and deal with them initially. And that would really help streamline the process. So I think we've still got our work cut out for us, Laddie.
I'd like to pose a question to these guys.
Yep, go ahead.
I never got to go to UCSB myself or in college, but one thing I always see and told about university people is they're always against anything unless it's environmental. And certainly all these years, Santa Barbara's been totally opposed to welcoming because they're big bad welcomers. They make all the profits, dirty us up. And so it's been a very unpopular thing for anyone to say, like we're saying, maybe we should be our friends, maybe we should partner with them and make the benefits instead of not. Well, you guys are here today, and Jim's gave you a presentation. And I thought there'd be a few rotten eggs thrown, a few tomatoes thrown, and there some really tough questions. And so far, I haven't heard squat. You guys seem like you're sleeping or something like that. I mean, where's the real questions at? I mean, you guys aren't buying this. I mean, you don't believe them, do you? I mean, except for you. I mean, you guys all believe what he told you?
All right, I'm going to tell a story here. And this is a Laddie story. I told him, Laddie, about how you wound up in the wheelchair and how you went off that cliff and broke your neck and rolled another 1,200 feet. I didn't tell him about the part when Laddie woke up in the hospital. He was in one of those halo things. His three ex-wives, the woman who'd sued him for palimony and his current girlfriend were all standing around the hospital bed, some of whom had not had the pleasure of meeting each other before. Laddie opened his eyes and said, "God, let me die."
Thank you.
Other questions out there? We got some questions, Bill. Who's got the mic? Yeah, sure.
Okay. So you said that, it's that with the old numbers, it was about 100 billion barrels of oil offshore in the entire United States.
Yeah. Is that Laddie saying it's 20 million barrels a day?
20, yeah. So multiply that by.
Yeah, that was billion barrels, the 110 billion.
So what was the total?
Check.
Laddie's saying 22.
About 22 million barrels a day in the U.S.
Okay.
So that seems like an awful lot. For it to be 100 billion barrels offshore?
110 billion is what they estimate. It's been in the areas that are offshore, off limits right now.
And we only use 1 billion a year?
22 million.
7 billion,
yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, it's a big number. And the other thing that you'll see in terms of technology, I've talked about the horizontal drilling. What you're hearing a lot now is about these shale plays. And what you're going to see is, you've already seen a complete difference between the price of oil and the price of natural gas. Natural gas, obviously, is a clean burning fuel. I think you will see by the year 2010 that we will again have an excess supply of natural gas. We'll be in a natural gas bubble. And that natural gas can then be used to fuel buses and that type of transportation. So again, but we need to drill. And I'm with all of those people. We need to be doing everything in terms of trying to establish energy independence. We got to drill for oil, drill for natural gas, try conversion. I'm not big on windmills, to be honest, but willing to try anything.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.